is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacy Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Where is Melody Buzzard? That is the question that authorities, family, anyone interested in this case are still asking. Ashley Buzzard now arrested. It's a case that really, when it comes down to it, when you really start to examine what's going on here, it's a mental health crisis. One with legs, one with a driver's license, one with agency to move and to explore the crisis as if it were reality. That's what we're going to be exploring here. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, joining us to break down this case. I'm trying to grab your book over here so I can hold it up. Here we go. Your memoir, Nightbird, out right now. And also The Minds of Mass Killers, available wherever books are sold. Siobhan, let's start here. This didn't start the day Melody went missing. Family had sounded alarms for years, reports that she hadn't been seen by some relatives for a very long time, questions about schooling, paperwork, the home, the living conditions described as squalor. And then there's wigs, there's a road trip, there's a swapped license plate, and finally, no child on the return trip. When you add all of this up, this looks like a very long runway to crisis that everyone could see and no one could stop. I want to start there about all of this, where people could see it, the family could see it, others could see it. But the way our system works allowed her to just kind of keep tooling along the world with the care, being the caregiver of her daughter, Melody. How is this how it works?
We have the most dysfunctional system when it comes to keeping kids safe. And how I would frame this, it's like there wasn't any one single big red flag, but there were yellow flags one after another, after another, after another that went on for years. And unfortunately, in the current legal situation with the courts and the Department of Child and Family Services in most places, it has to rise to such a level of risk. I mean, basically, you can say there has to be blood on the floor before legal action can be taken. And we need to do it differently, although that's very hard to do because there are very strong forces that are highly political that stress parental rights and will fight these attempts to redo the system. I mean, there are political forces that say we need to do away with child protection agencies and that parent rights trump all. But I don't think, as you said, there was any question here that there was a mental health condition going on. I did see one of the interviews, which certainly would fit, is that the mother, Ashley, had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, had a prior psychiatric hospitalization. And we know that, of course, bipolar disorder is not uncommon, but you can look at it on a continuum. And when people have a severe case, they often become delusional, they may have hallucinations, and they get paranoid. Super, super common. But there are lots and lots, literally millions of people, I would guess, out there with mental health conditions who are raising children. And it's horrifying to see. And often yellow flag after yellow flag after yellow flag.
And when we have these flags, there's not a lot outside forces can do. And we're speaking here specifically on the Buzzard case, but I mean, you can apply this to almost any sort of situation. If you have a son, a daughter, a brother, whoever, someone in your life that you care about, whether it's blood or not, you're someone who gives a damn about their well-being. And you see that there is something that is taking over them, that there is a mental health condition that is spiraling and they need help. Those are not usually the folks who are suffering that are going to raise their hand and go, there's something really off here, really wrong. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they don't even realize anything's going on. It's those on the outside that are seeing it. But who has the power to get help in those situations?
Well, what I would suggest to families where they have doubts about somebody's stability and ability to care for their child is make report after report after report. Keep notes, document you know, if you get weird messages or strange voicemails, document, 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 keep dates, stick to the facts, and keep reporting over and over and over. Because sometimes you don't see action with the first or the second report, but if there's a consistent pattern, and the more people who report, the better, you know, you may start to see that there are visits out to the home. And again, that's no promise that anything is going to change quickly. But sometimes that's all you can do is just keep rattling the cage. You can report to police. You can report to the child protection agency. But you just have to keep doing it.
So, Siobhan, where is this line between somebody is troubled, like they are starting to spiral, And where is dangerous? Where does that line get crossed that, holy crap, we need to do something. This child is in danger. Or mom or dad, they're suffering from a mental illness and they're just having a rough go of it. Because, you know, the state of the world is such that you're going to have some difficult days. That's just how it goes. But when do they cross over to, we need to do something now?
A huge gray area there, right? And I think legally, I don't agree with this, but I think legally the risk has to be current, demonstrable, and it, basically the child is neglected, abused, or not having their basic needs for food and shelter met. And it has to be so extreme that the child is at imminent risk. And how is that going to be determined? I've seen families in the community mental health system where the parents were homeless, living in a tent, and reports had been made that the child was not sufficiently sheltered, but when it was investigated, it didn't meet the bar for any kind of immediate action. And then even if it does get to a judge, the priority of the court pretty uniformly is to come up with a reunification plan or a safety plan in order to keep the family together. And keeping the family together seems to be a higher priority than keeping children safe and in a home where they're well cared for. So it's a huge gray area. And yeah, courts can't remove kids due to a parental eccentric behaviors or even hallucinations, as long as the kids are fed, sheltered, and their very basic needs are met, nothing changes. And that's where I think we just have to keep speaking out about it. And relatives who are seeing these things, they just have to keep calling, keep calling.
Who's making the judgment call on whether this is a safe place for the kids? And what sort of qualifications do they have to be making these judgment calls? Because we see this far too often where, well, someone did visit and they thought, well, this is still satisfactory enough to keep the kids there.
Yeah, I've never been a child welfare employee or a social worker in that capacity, but I think they have a checklist and a scoring system. And this has ultimately been something that's put together by states and local counties. And so you find it can be somewhat different in every locale, which again is a problem. You don't have consistency from one community to another. And so a parent that may be flagged in one county can move across, you know, move literally across the street and now be under the radar again in a different location. But ultimately, if a case gets in front of a judge, it would be the judge's call. And judges typically will go for a family safety plan or reunification plan. And the Department of Children's Services is in charge of coming up with that plan. So it's all done according to a checklist. And it may be everything that the social workers would like to see something change and want to see something happen. And as I've mentioned before, I have had a lot of those folks come to therapy in distress over their inability to see movement, you know, in the court system.
Wow. Ultimately, you know, you hope that someone who is in that position as a CPS worker or whatever capacity, whatever title it may be in whatever state, that, you know, the interest is that of the welfare of the children. Yeah. But on a complete professional level, let's take emotion out of it. Let's take the welfare of the children out of it for a moment to better understand what is the motivating factor here. What's going on when they have a caseload that's far larger than they're ever going to be able to tackle because there's not enough of them and they're understaffed and they're underpaid. And in no way am I trying to say anything bad about the people who are working in this industry, in this world, in this area, with good intentions that are doing their job and doing the best they can. They are saints and they all get burned out at some point, and rightfully so. But let's just for a moment look at the kind of the structure of all of this. How does this work? Is there a reason? Is there incentive? Is there a reason why one would want to, like, let's mark this off as okay and move on to our next one? Because of time constraints, because of staffing constraints, because of this or that, the ability to pay enough attention where they want to, where they should be, where they can or can't. What are some of these other factors that are playing in here relative to the job requirements and what they need to do to basically get their job done and check the box at the end of the day to keep collecting a paycheck?
Yeah, I think it's just built into the structure of the system. You know, you nailed it with there aren't enough social workers to keep up. And there have been cases, fortunately rare, but there have been cases where there was a bad outcome, a child died. And when they went back and, you know, did an audit and went over everything, the notes of the social worker had been falsified and they really had not laid eyes on the kids. So these people work under tremendous pressure and it's just flawed. You know, from the basic rules that prioritize family reunification above all, which was based on really old research going back decades, that was the way it should go.
And we want to talk about that.
Yeah, I
want to talk about that specifically of the family reunification because I mean, in some cases, does it make sense? Sure. In many, I don't know. I mean, I'm just basing on my experience, what I've seen with school systems, with people, with kids and some families. I don't know. I would venture to say more than not, there shouldn't be any sort of reunification because that's where the problem started to begin with. And if we're looking at patterns of behavior of people, people tend to have patterns of behavior and they tend to keep doing the same stupid shit over and over and over. And the system doesn't seem to account for any of that when it comes to family reunification. Mm-hmm. So let's go way back. Why was this the best idea at some point in time? And why does it not make any sense today?
Yeah, I believe it goes back to research that was done in the 70s, you know, and there was one study that I don't think was a well done study, but somebody, you know, got this into the legislative system that children did better in being reunified with their families than they did in foster care. And society, I have to say, I think it's deteriorated a lot since then. Yeah. We've got way more people with drug problems that have left them impaired. That is just a huge problem. And, you know, what we talked a few weeks ago about the date, I believe it was in the 1920s, that we didn't even have laws in this country about child abuse that people could be prosecuted, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the very first case that was prosecuted was in New York, a child abuse case, and they had to prosecute it under a cruelty to animals law because we didn't have any laws about cruelty to children being a crime. So we're way out of reality here with, you know, even having judges that have adequate training in child development and what kids need and the impact of bouncing around. There are laws now that kids, if they've been in foster care for X number of years, I don't remember how long it is, 2 or 3 years or something like that, that they do need to look at terminating parental rights. But that's fairly new. And, you know, so that is a change, but we need to do a lot more. And yeah, you're right. It's like, as I say, yellow flag after yellow flag after yellow flag, there's a pattern here. And, you know, some of the things we can do are get teams where you have, you know, not just reports to law enforcement, but where you team clinicians, mental health clinicians with law enforcement that go out into the home when there have been reports, and you spend time doing an evaluation. And that's not something that's done now. It typically is a quick checklist, or they go out, the parents don't answer the door. And so it gets delayed, you know, and it can take ages to even get anybody out there to visit.
Well, and that doesn't seem right. I mean, if somebody says, I haven't seen my nephew or my niece, you know, in 6 months, 3 months, whatever that time frame is, and I'm concerned, that should trigger immediate action from mm-hmm. some sort of authorities. And granted, you're going to have some of these cases where you've got, you know, mm-hmm. your paranoid mm-hmm. Uncle Jeff, you know, who's right. just not in his right mind and he drinks a lot or whatever the case may be. But it would be concerning if this child weren't in school, if mm-hmm. homeschooling isn't showing any accountability for this child. There are lots of things that start stacking, and we need to do something and see, where is this child? Produce this child. I don't understand why we don't have immediate action when the data stacks up as it does. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, you're right. I agree with you completely. And I think a lot of times in these cases where people make false complaints,
right.
and one of the things that's looked at is, has there been contention in the family where people are fighting and they don't get along, or there's been a bad divorce or a bad custody battle going on. Mm-hmm. And so people will start making false complaints to CPS. So that's another thing that they have to evaluate. Are these family members just angry because they're not getting visitation with the child because there's a breach in the family system? And, mm-hmm. you know, so a lot of times the kids aren't in danger, but you're right. You don't know. And particularly when you layer one thing on top of another, the child is not in school, there was a quick withdrawal, or when the child was in school, they show up without a coat when it's snowing outside. You know, I've seen cases like that. I've seen cases where the school janitor bought a child a coat because they were so worried about the child, and they couldn't get anybody to take action because the kid would show up cold. So,
well, at the end of the day, look, you're either going to have common sense on how to raise a child or you're not. And having a CPS worker come over there and scold you and go through their checklist and say you're failing isn't going to magically make them a better parent.
No.
But that seems to be how we think it's going to work. And we don't do anything about it. We're like, well, let's wait till it gets even worse, and then maybe we can take the kids away. Yeah. Till then, we're going to write you up. We're going to say, you need to change this. So the next time we come around, and if they don't, they don't, and they won't, and most times they don't, because they're not capable.
Right.
And that seems to be a thing that, again, this is a word a lot of people don't like to use because people would rather go with hopeful language. Mm-hmm. I'm just being real. Some people are not capable of certain shit, and that may be some very basic things. Mm-hmm. And if we can recognize that they're just not capable, they're not, if they're too stupid to put a coat on their child, if they can't figure out how to crack an egg and make them food, mm-hmm. they're not capable of caring for a child.
Mm-hmm.
There's a many, many ways you can care for a child with very, very little income. There mm-hmm. are.
Yeah.
But you have to be intelligent enough to figure out how to do that. And if these people clearly are struggling and taking care of themselves, why the hell are we sitting here thinking, oh yeah, you can certainly take care of these five that you shit out?
Yeah. No, that's a real problem. And often the folks with the least capacity to care for their kids are the ones that have the most kids. They have a lot of children.
Yeah.
And that's, again, that's showing impaired judgment. That's showing a likely mental health problem or an addiction problem. And sending them to six sessions of a parenting class it's not going to change that. They, as you say, they don't have the capacity.
Again, though, I'm playing devil's advocate here, because I sit here as somebody who chose not to help children, intentionally did not want to have children. But aren't we taking away people's ability to, I hate saying it, but isn't it their right to have children if they want to? I mean,
no.
Okay, well, but how do you stop them?
Not if you can't care for the kid, no.
But how do you know if you can't care for them?
they're struggling, if they're barely able to eat, they're not getting nutrition, they're not being cared for by societal standards. It's not your right just to keep. It's like having a prisoner at that point. But the way our system works, it does tend to work more like, yes, this is your right.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of what I'm getting at. Believe me, I feel like.
Yeah.
I feel like we should limit who can have kids.
Oh, I really agree. Do. Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm sitting back going, well, I'm sure there's somebody out there saying, well, wait a minute, you can't take away people's rights to have children
if they want it.
You
can't do that, but you can take away the children if you're not going to take care of them, the same way they can take away a pet.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but we live in a country based upon the rights of the individual, and that seems to be, you know, when the legal system, when laws are created, the rights of the individual come first in everything. It's just like people have the right to be mentally ill on the street and eat. I was told that in one of the agencies when I was trying to do a adult protective services report because a guy who was severely mentally ill was eating out of trash cans. Okay. You know, garbage dumps outside of restaurants. And it was just horrifying to me. And I said, can't he be taken in for a 5150? It was the law in California where you're placed on a 72-hour hold, evaluated, try to get him into treatment. We live in a country where I was told by a county attorney, the law says we live in a country where you are free to be crazy on the street and eat out of garbage cans if that's your choice. And, you know... if that were my relative, I would want to be rescuing them from that. And we do these things that we think are all about individual rights, but there's a lack of compassion. And it doesn't sound very wise. So, I vote for Tony for president.
Rights aren't rights when they're hurting people. That's not a right. That no longer is a right. And that's the insane part of all of this. Answer me this. I want to ask about the parenting classes where, okay, we're going to send you to the parenting class. Tell me, honestly, in your experience, how often do folks go to these parenting classes and come out different people?
Yeah, you know they don't come out different people. You know they don't.
They get a certificate to put on their dirty refrigerator.
Yeah, and they may learn the jargon that they're supposed to say. You know, I would support my child's self-esteem. What does that mean? How do you do that? And I've asked parents those questions after parenting classes. And when you explore a little deeper, how does this actually change how they behave with their kid? It doesn't.
No.
And they don't have a clue. But it's sort of like sending, you know, domestic violence offenders who are chronically violent with women they're involved in and sending them to anger management. It's like, same frustration. There's so much wrong. Yeah.
We do these things because it makes us feel better.
We're checking the box.
Exactly. Yeah. It's checking the box. We're saying we did everything we could by saying, go into this box over here and come out a different person.
Yeah.
Shake the box up. Still, actually more damage. They just have more skills on how to work the system at the end of the day. And we expect different results. And we've done it forever.
Yeah.
Why do you think we can't get reform in these areas? Why is it that this, I keep saying it, I would think this would be a big ballot issue, that if somebody were to campaign on this, people would be like, oh my God, this is horrible. Yes, we need to reform this, but we never see it happen. It's always some other one-off that gets people enraged on something that affects a minute portion of the population. Mm-hmm. This is big. Mm-hmm. This is tons and tons. This is the future generations here and a huge chunk of it. And we're just like, good luck. Mm-hmm. Why, in your opinion, do you think it is that we never see any sort of reforms on this come to light? And it just kind of sits status quo.
I think there's just a huge social denial. People don't like to think about it. They skip over the awful stories in the news. It's like, oh, that's negative. I don't want to think about it. And they go into this magical thinking where they actually believe that the system works because it's too uncomfortable to look at the truth. And You know, I think we do a better job. I, as you know, I'm on Facebook, social media. I'm involved because I care about animals too. And there is so much attention on social media about loving animals, which that's why I'm in the groups, because I believe in that. But that's a more comfortable topic, taking care of our pets and taking care of the abandoned animals or the abused animals. People get really fired up about that. But there's this denial about the situation of many kids in our society. And I think on, you know, what do people talk about on most YouTube channels? They're not talking about cruelty to kids that often. They're talking about other things. And I appreciate so much that this is an area of passion for you, and that you're willing to go there and spend some time digging in.
Well, and the reality is the infrastructures, the YouTubes and things out there, they shut these sort of conversations down because they're icky, because they're uncomfortable, because they make people feel triggered.
Yeah.
Be triggered.
Yeah.
There's a reason you're triggered, because there's a problem, and pretending it doesn't exist or throttling the topic doesn't help anyone.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, even that's how it works. Would it be better if we found some sort of pill to give children that makes them extremely furry and hairy, so they started resembling small wolves rather than children? Would people start giving a shit maybe a little bit more?
Probably. It's easier. It's easier to care about animals. But if we're going to talk, you know, magic solutions, let's go with people can only earn their sexual organs after they've demonstrated a certain capacity for good judgment. And so you're just preventing procreation, you know, when folks do not have a certain standard of, you know, I have the capacity to care for a life I may be creating here.
Can I jump in and be really controversial for just a second?
You did the wolf pill thing as a child, didn't you?
No, I did not. But let's think this through, and I'm going to upset somebody out there. That's fine. But you have to take driving lessons. You have to take a test to get your driver's license. What if we are all infertile until we've passed our parenting test?
Yeah.
How are you going to do that?
I don't freaking know. I don't know. I'm just throwing. I have no idea.
Well, Mormons have magic underwear. I mean, that's worked so well.
Are they that wrong at this point? I mean,
well, it hasn't worked. They just tend to reproduce a lot of them. And then a few of them end up going off and making other versions of their religion. They all go, that's not like us. Like, not at all.
Giving us material. Yeah, I know.
I think it's kind of interesting. We're talking about the animal kingdom and things like that. In the animal kingdom, if there are animals that are bad parents and they're not taking care of their young, other members of that species will step in and be the parents.
Will.
And it would be nice if we could somehow get to that point as human beings where those of us in the peripheral of what's going on could step in and say, hey, something's not right here, and be listened to just once. Well,
thank you,
Todd. I think that's a big point and a big problem in this, because I think there are a lot of people who do want to step in, but they can't.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.